Beyond Barbarossa, Episode 89, The Battle of Belgrade. Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English-language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Redbeard Studio on traditional Anishinaabeg Algonquin land, also called Ottawa, in the free, independent, and sovereign Canada. I'm alone in the Redbeard Studio today, uncharacteristically. Neither of my assistants, Daisy the Dager Doodle, nor Ragnar the Magnificent Ragdoll, are here. So I'll have to see if I can manage to get through on my own. This is episode 89, and we're going to look closely at the liberation of Yugoslavia, if we can call it liberation, and the battle for its capital, Belgrade, between the Red Army, Yugoslavian partisans, and of course, the Axis. As much as this podcast attempts to present the story of the Eastern Front chronologically with an 81-year delay, the autumn of 1944 presents a special problem with so much happening across a vast territory, virtually all of Eastern Europe. So many operations overlapping in time and space and all affecting each other. All that to explain why the past several episodes, even though I'm trying to do this chronologically, they've all been focused on operations at happening at the same time from September to November 1944. From episode 83 about the Warsaw Rising in August, episode 85 on operations in Finland and Romania, episode 86 on the Baltic operations that drove the German Army Group north into the Courland and Memel pockets, episode 87 on Hungary, and the last episode, number 88, on the Red Army's initial abortive and horrible incursion into East Prussia. All these were overlapping operations, each one starting before the previous one ended, which underscores the immense size of the Red Army and massive resources it could bring to bear on multiple huge operations simultaneously. So this episode, we're not going to have our usual feature, what else is happening in the war, because we're still talking about the same period as the past several episodes, the autumn of 1944. I'll just summarize quickly. In Europe, the situation is this. The Western Allies have liberated most of Italy, almost into the Po River Valley. British and Free Greek forces, who were still divided amongst themselves, but anyway, have driven German occupiers out of Greece. Canadians have liberated Belgium and are pushing into the Netherlands. And the Americans are approaching the pre-war French-German border. Now I want to look at the political dimensions. The political dimensions of the Second World War on the Eastern Front were always underlying drivers of the action. For example, episode 83, Warsaw Rises, was the story of the Warsaw Rising from August to September. Encouraged by the Allies, in particular Moscow, through a series of radio broadcasts, the Polish Home Army, the biggest and the most organized national resistance force in Nazi-occupied countries in the war, rose in rebellion against its brutal occupiers. This began on the evening of 1st of August, as the Red Army reached the Vistula River across from the Polish capital. And even as units of the Moscow-backed and controlled Polish People's Army entered Warsaw's eastern suburbs. The Home Army expected, hoped, that the Red Army would continue its sweep westward, driving the Nazis out. So they needed to assert control on behalf of the legitimate democratically elected government of Poland, which was then in exile in London. It was only if they could do this before the Soviets took power, they could make sure that their new liberated government was a government of Poland, not a Moscow puppet. The Rising didn't quite work out that way. Instead, the Red Armies malingered outside of Warsaw, claiming they had exceeded their supply lines and needed to bring their logistics up to the new front lines. But there was much more to it than that. It's clear that the Soviets intended to have the Poles and Germans wear each other out in Warsaw, clearing the way for an easy victory for themselves and the establishment of a Moscow puppet in Warsaw. They did not let Western allies use air bases in Soviet-occupied southeastern Europe, nor allow British nor American planes land to just refuel there, which would allow them a longer flight with more payload to bring munitions, weapons, or supplies for the Home Army. Now ensued a very strange episode, one largely ignored by mainstream Western historians, or at least the Hollywood version, and it certainly wasn't in the history that I learned in high school. On 9th October 1944, UK Prime Minister Winston Churchill arrived in Moscow to meet with Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin by himself, without Roosevelt, the other and arguably most important of the big three leaders. This is very strange when you consider how opposed Churchill was to communism before the war, as well as after. At other times, he had described the Soviet system as Bolshevism and baboonery. Love that word. But here he was in October 1944, meeting with Stalin privately. He refused to have the American ambassador to the USSR, Roosevelt's right-hand man, Avril Harriman, sit in on these meetings. Churchill said, quote, he did not want this to prevent intimate talk between Marshal Stalin and himself, end quote. In their private meeting, Churchill presented what he called a naughty document. Not what you're thinking. This document was written in pencil on a small piece of paper. It's something that he jotted down, apparently, on the flight from London to Moscow. The idea was it divided Eastern European countries, or the control of these countries, following the end of the war between the UK and the USSR after the war. What distinguished Churchill's proposal from the earlier Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact at the beginning of the war, which also divided the control of Eastern European countries between two other countries, more powerful countries, was Churchill's plan, proposal, was a lot more complicated. Instead of assigning a small country to the control of a superpower outright, even though it's at this point questionable, or even less than questionable, the UK would remain a superpower in the world. But at any rate, Churchill's proposal was that Britain and the USSR would have varying proportions of influence over countries in Eastern Europe. For example, Churchill proposed that the Soviets would have 90% predominance or control over influence in Romania, where the UK got the remaining 10%. On the other hand, the UK would have 90% of the say in Greece and the Soviets 10%. The two entities, empires, would share 50-50 power in Hungary and Yugoslavia, and the USSR would have 75% of the power in Bulgaria. I have no idea how this influence sharing would work practically, but Stalin apparently liked the idea. He signed off on it in pencil. To quote from author, historian, and podcaster Giles Milton in The Stalin Affair, The Impossible Alliance That Won the War, Churchill was correct to call it a naughty document. Neither the people nor parliaments of Central or Eastern Europe had been consulted about such a sweeping proposition, nor indeed had the PM discussed it with his cabinet, and Roosevelt himself was completely oblivious to Churchill's extraordinary proposition. With that one small slip of paper, and in barely any time at all, he was sealing the fate of millions of newly liberated people. End quote. The attitude displayed by this episode played out in real terms in the autumn of 1944 when it came to the issue of post-war Poland. There were actually multilateral discussions involving the Soviets, Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt's people about the post-war borders and status of the liberated countries of Eastern Europe. Now, Stalin wanted to literally move Poland 100 miles or 160 kilometers westward. So territory in what had been before the war, Eastern Poland, would become part of the Soviet Socialist States of Lithuania, Belorussia, and Ukraine. Poland would be compensated with land from Germany, including East Prussia. Well, except for a triangle on the Baltic coast around Konigsberg, which persists today as Kaliningrad. As you'd expect, the Poles objected strongly to this. But Churchill said to the head of the Polish government in exile in London, Stanisław Mikołajczyk, quote, "We are not going to wreck the peace of Europe because of quarrels between Poles. Unless you accept the frontier, you are out of business forever. The Russians will sweep through your country and your people will be liquidated. You are on the verge of annihilation." End quote. In other words, you don't have any cards. History doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. So now let's focus on Yugoslavia. A bit of background. Yugoslavia, before the Second World War, was a kingdom formed by the unification of the Kingdom of Serbia with certain sections of Austria-Hungary that was broken up following the First World War. The Serbian royal family became monarchs of the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. Their first king, Peter I, renamed the country Yugoslavia officially in 1929. It means Land of the South Slavs. And it was already called that colloquially. He just made it official. Thankfully, much less of a mouthful. Peter I died in 1921. His son became King Alexander I, and he was assassinated in 1934. His son, Peter, was 11 at the time. So Alexander's cousin, Paul, became regent until 1941, when Peter came of age. As you know, this was a stressful time in Eastern Europe. In Yugoslavia, there was intense ethnic strife between Serbs and Croats. Some things never change, leading to subdivision of the country with almost independent or autonomous regions for Croats, Slovenes, and so on. Meanwhile, the Yugoslavian government was trying to recover from the Great Depression through closer ties with Germany and Italy. On 25th March 1941, the Yugoslavian government signed the Tripartite Pact under great pressure. So the Tripartite Pact was, of course, the alliance between Germany, Italy, and Japan, which we mostly call the Axis now. This signature, this acquiescence to Germany, sparked massive protests in the capital, Belgrade. 2 days later, a military coup d'etat overthrew Prince Paul's regency and put Peter II on the throne. He withdrew de facto support for the Axis without formally renouncing membership in the Tripartite Pact. So, on 6 April 1941, the Axis invaded Yugoslavia, the Germans, more specifically. The Wehrmacht finished the conquest of this big country in less than 2 weeks. The royal family escaped to British Kenya, and the Germans divided Yugoslavia up. Hungary and Bulgaria, the Axis junior European members, all took parts of the country away. Italy added the governorship of Dalmatia along the Adriatic coast, plus nearly half of Slovenia, all of Montenegro, and parts of Kosovo and Macedonia to its holdings. Keep in mind that the Italians already had occupied Albania, another country to the south of Yugoslavia. This left Croatia as a nominally independent state with a king, Tomislav II, but it was really controlled by fascist Ante Pavelić. And that left a rump Serbian state under German military administration. What ensued was a confusing, messy war of occupation and resistance, typical of Eastern Europe during the Second World War. Resistance to German occupation was largely done by two main groups, the Chetniks, formerly the Yugoslav Army of the Fatherland, or JVUO, under General Draža Mihailović. They were anti-German, anti-fascist, and anti-communist. The other major group were the communist partisans led by Josip Broz, called Tito, after Roman Emperor Titus. Formerly, they were called the National Liberation Army and Partisan Detachments of Yugoslavia, abbreviated in Serbo-Croatian as NOVJ. But I'll refer to them as the Partisans for the rest of this episode. Historian Antony Bivor describes the Partisans this way. Tito organized his forces into 1,000-strong brigades, but was wise enough not to attempt conventional military tactics. Discipline was strict, and no fraternizing was allowed between men and the large number of young women fighting in their ranks. By the autumn of 1942, Tito's partisans had virtual control in their mountainous region extending across western Bosnia and eastern Croatia, and he set up his headquarters in the town of Biha after expelling the Ustashi. End quote. The Ustashi being the Croatian Nazi collaborationist militia at the time. As you can imagine, there were major differences between the Chetniks and the partisans, the most obvious being that the partisans were communists and the Chetniks were anti-communist. As the war continued, and especially as the Soviets began to push the Germans back and come into Yugoslavia, the anti-communist Chetniks began to collaborate more frequently with the German and Italian occupiers. And the Western allies shifted their support in the form of intelligence and drops of supplies fully to the communist partisans, explains Antony Bivor. During 1942, Ultra intercepts and other reports indicated that Tito's forces were attacking the Germans, while the Chetniks waited. Attempts by SOE liaison officers, that's the Special Operations Executive, British intelligence basically, attempts by SOE liaison officers parachuted in to persuade the rival resistance movements to work together had little success. So, as Allied interest in the Mediterranean increased, once the Germans had been vanquished in North Africa, the British made contact with Tito. End quote. Bivor later adds, the British decided to aid the communists on the grounds that they were fighting harder. End quote. I'm going to turn now to another author that I really admire and depend on to help me research this podcast. Evan Maudsley writes in Thunder in the East, the Nazi-Soviet War, 1941 to 1945, Yugoslavia was more important politically than militarily. A key factor was the radical program of the partisans. This was a resistance movement very unlike that of the Home Army in Poland. Tito, the Croat Josip Broz, was a communist and former Comintern operative. The partisans were able to secure a large region of the rugged country away from the main transport route, and in 1942 they created a prototype for successful resistance in the form of the Anti-Fascist Assembly for the Popular Liberation of Yugoslavia. An Executive National Committee for the Liberation of Yugoslavia was set up under Tito at the end of 1943 to become the government of the liberated zone and the heir apparent to power once Germany was defeated. End quote. Throughout the war, the partisans played an important role in tying down the Germans with multiple major resistance operations and attacks on German occupiers. By 1944, the partisans numbered some 800,000 men organized into four field armies. In May 1944, the Wehrmacht planned a major operation, Rosselsprung, or Knight's Move, as in chess, with the express purpose of killing Tito. This operation involved airborne parachute troops as well as ground troops, plus the Chetniks, the Yugoslavs opposed to Tito's communists. In May 1944, the operation started with a Luftwaffe bombing of the town of Drvar, where the partisans had their headquarters, followed by an attack by the ground forces. Tito and his headquarters staff managed to escape. Other partisan groups and units of the partisan armies counterattacked, and the German operation failed. It was around this time, so the spring of 1944, that the Western Allies stepped up their bombing operations from Italy into Yugoslavia. These operations coincided nicely with the Soviets and their new allies moving into Yugoslavia by September 1944. So that's the situation in Yugoslavia in coming into the autumn. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll get into the Battle of Belgrade itself.
As Scott elegantly describes in each episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the war on the Eastern Front was truly gargantuan, both in terms of its geography and its destructiveness. But given that there is so much territory to cover, and that so many millions of men were involved in the fighting, it's perhaps inevitable that some battles from the Eastern Front get overlooked. I'm David Sumner, and I'm the host of Europe at War, a weekly podcast exploring lesser-known battles and stories of the Second World War, with a particular focus on the Eastern Front. From the drama of thousands of trapped German soldiers and terrified civilians attempting to break out of the Halba Pocket, to the unexpected and blistering counterattack launched by German forces on the Red Army during the Battle of Bautzen, many of the Eastern Front's most dramatic battles, particularly those which happened towards the end of the war, have long been neglected by historians, and their stories have remained untold. Until now. So to hear these incredible tales from the Eastern Front, and more, check out Europe at War, available on all podcast platforms. Thank you. Now let's get back to the show.
Hi, Scott here. I hope you enjoy this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. As far as I can tell, Beyond Barbarossa is still the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating and or a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Amazon, or whichever platform you listen to it. That helps let other people know about it and find it more easily. Patreon is another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you prefer. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War with Finland and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the USSR in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Won't hurt. Patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks. Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. Beyond Barbarossa is still, as far as I can tell, the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Welcome to part 2 of episode 89 of Beyond Barbarossa. We're now going to bring all our protagonists and antagonists together in Yugoslavia and the ultimate prize, the capital city, Belgrade. A quick note on geography. Just to help orient you, there is a map on the webpage for this episode. Belgrade is at the confluence of the Sava with the Danube River. So, the background is, in late September, three Bulgarian armies, the Bulgarians were now allied with the Soviets, remember, totaling 455,000 men, entered Yugoslavia to block the Germans withdrawing from Greece. The Brits and the Greek resistance had pushed them out of that country, and that may be the subject of a special bonus episode in the future. The Yugoslavian Partisans 23rd Division captured the town of Zajacar in eastern Serbia on 7 September after fierce fighting with police battalions and auxiliary military units. A week later, they took the town of Negotin, about 50 kilometers or 30 miles northeast. So this established sort of a line beyond which the Germans were pushed, running rough northeast to southwest. The Germans responded, of course, sending in the 1st Mountain Division on 9th September, engaging the partisans who were determined to keep them out of the Danube Valley. This German division, commanded by General Hans Felber, retook Zajacar and reached the Danube River closer to Negotin by mid-September. The 1st Mountain Division, augmented by three more regiments, including the 18th SS Mountain Police Regiment, attacked the left or northern bank of the Danube in an attempt to take control of the Iron Gates. This is a striking gorge on the border between Serbia and Romania. It's a historic area, the site of the Bridge of Roman Emperor Trajan. And there's a map and a nice picture on the webpage for this episode. Anyway, the Germans' effort failed when the Red Army's 75th Corps, which was moving westward in the same region, met them from the east. The Reds crossed the Danube on 22nd September. The Germans counterattacked and held them off. The 57th Red Army added three more corps to this operation, and by the end of the month of September had retaken Negotin and were fighting in Zajacar again. On 8th October, the Bulgarian People's Army and troops from the Soviet 3rd Ukrainian Front crossed the pre-war border into Yugoslavia. According to Evan Maudsley, quote, "The Yugoslavs reluctantly agreed to allow Bulgarian troops to support an attack on Niš in eastern Serbia. But the Stavka, the Soviet High Military Command, had to get directly involved." End quote. Crossing the pre-war Bulgarian-Yugoslavian border, the Red Army and Bulgarian armies encountered German defenses, but the Wehrmacht was more interested in withdrawing by now to more defensible positions farther west. To support these advances, the Western Allies sent 1,973 aircraft, mostly from the 15th U.S. Air Force, to bomb German and collaborationist air bases and participate as air support during those ground operations. The trouble was, this air support caused a number of friendly fire incidents where these US and UK planes mistakenly bombed Soviet and partisan forces. One of the most infamous incidents was the Nish incident of 7th November, when P-38 Lightnings from the 82nd Fighter Group of the 15th U.S. Air Force, based in southern Italy, flew a mission to strike German motorized columns and trains in southern Serbia. Around 10 a.m. on the 7th, they attacked a column of vehicles moving from the town of Nish northward toward Belgrade. They strafed the column. By this time, though, the town of Nish was under Soviet control. The Red Air Force had an air base near the town. The commander of the 17th Air Army, General Vladimir Sudets, ordered the 886th Fighter Aviation Regiment to counterattack what he thought were German fighters from the Luftwaffe. The P-38 Lightning has an airframe similar in design to the Focke Wulf FW-189. I put some pictures on the webpage for this episode so you can see this for yourself. Now, as the Soviet planes, the Yakovlev Yak-9s, approached the American P-38s, the Americans turned their fire on the Soviet planes, even though they are marked clearly with a great big red star on the sides. You can see that in the picture of the plane in the Russian Air Force Museum that I put on the webpage. One of the Yak-9s was shot down immediately, so a second flight of Yak-9s joined the fight, as did anti-aircraft fire from the Nish airbase. They shot down one of the Lightnings, and then one of their own planes. By the end of the fighting, two P-38s had been shot down, three Yak-9s, including the one brought down by Soviet anti-aircraft fire, and over 30 Red Army soldiers were dead on the ground, including Red Army General Grigory Kotov, killed in that initial American strafing run on the Red Army vehicle column. That was the Nish incident, which, as you can imagine, caused a huge international uproar. The U.S. officially apologized to the Soviet Union, stating that the incident was due to a, quote, grave error by American pilots sent to attack German forces, end quote. On 14 December, Averell Harriman, U.S. ambassador to the USSR, apologized to the Soviet government. To prevent further errors, the Soviets, Stalin, insisted on a clear line of demarcation between air operations of the two allies. In other words, you stay on your side of the line, we stay on our side of the line, we don't have these accidental encounters, and by the way, I get to keep all the territory my army's conquered. And now finally, let's zoom in on Belgrade. At this point, the Soviet Army, the Red Army, was moving like a red tide, as they had been since, well, 1943. German Army Group F was the force stationed in and around Belgrade responsible for keeping Serbia under control. They brought in everything they could to try to hold the tide back. But the Wehrmacht of late 1944 was not even a shadow of the force of 1941, not even of early 1943. On 5th October, Army Group F moved its headquarters out of Belgrade to Vukovar, Croatia, 143 kilometers or 95 miles west. The tide was coming fast. In 24 hours from 7th to 8th November, the 5th Guards Motorized Rifle Brigade itself moved 120 kilometers from Negotin, an incredible distance in wartime. The Germans tried clever tactics. I mean, that's what they were known for, like splitting their defenses into three groups to hold back their adversaries advancing on three separate axes toward Belgrade from the north, the east, and the south. It didn't work. Despite these clever maneuvers, the Soviets, the Bulgarians, and Yugoslav partisans kept coming closer. By 13 October 1944, the 1st Brigade of the Partisans' 5th Division had reached the Danube River just south of Belgrade. This advance cut off the 2nd Brandenburg Regiment of the 1st Mountain Division, the group mentioned earlier. Encircled, they tried to break out to the west, but suffered heavy casualties. From south of the city, the Red Army's 36th Tank Brigade charged in with Serbian soldiers riding on the tanks. At the same time, more partisans attacked from the west. By the end of the day, they overran a German garrison in Topola, a small town south of Belgrade. On 14 October, the Red Army's 4th Guards Mechanized Corps broke through the German defenses south of Belgrade. Meanwhile, the partisans were moving in from south of the Sava River, which, as I mentioned, empties into the Danube River from the south at Belgrade. Meanwhile, other units of the Red Army were coming down from the north. The Germans knew it was hopeless. Army Group E, which was located more southward of Belgrade in Serbia and Kosovo, tried to evacuate along the Morava and South Morava rivers, but they were cut off by the partisan 13th Corps and 2nd Bulgarian Army. They ended up moving through Montenegro, very hilly, mountainous country, hence the name, to the south of Serbia, instead of where the German command needed them, north in Hungary. By 20 October, the partisans and the Red Army completed control of Belgrade. To quote again from Evan Maudsley, "The German front in Yugoslavia then stabilized about 50 miles west of Belgrade and further south around Kraljevo. The railway had been cut, but the Germans were able to continue pulling their troops out of Greece along the Skopje-Kraljevo-Sarajevo road." End quote. I won't say that Belgrade and most of Serbia were liberated at this point. The Soviets were now in control, and that didn't look anything like liberation. On the other hand, the Germans were out and were in a very difficult position. The Yugoslav partisans now controlled a bridgehead on the north bank of the Danube at Baranja, giving them a great launching pad for an offensive toward Budapest, Hungary. Of course, the cost was high, but not as high as in most other Soviet operations. Soviet sources claim that their losses in Yugoslavia, or specifically Belgrade, were around 8,000, and half of that in the final push to take Belgrade. But the Bulgarians lost over 3,000, and the Yugoslav partisans lost 2,953 during that final attack on Belgrade. These numbers, though, don't take into account all of the losses through the fighting in Yugoslavia over these months. German losses were in Belgrade itself were light in comparison to the Soviets, also in comparison to other battles for cities at this time. They claimed fewer than 500 German and Italian soldiers lost in Belgrade, but that has a lot to do with the fact that they had pulled most of their forces out of the city before the Red Army and partisans got there. That number also does not take into account Army Group E, which was cut off before the final assault on Belgrade, and had to try to break out to the south. Estimates of their losses go as high as 15,000, but they're not easy to verify. The loss of Belgrade and Serbia put the Germans, as I said, in a very bad position. The Red Army held important bridgeheads over the Danube and were in Hungary, as described last episode, and as I mentioned, Army Group E was still fighting its way westward to Bosnia. But that's a good place to leave off this episode. Thank you for listening to Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. As always, you can find maps and lots of historical photos on the webpage for this episode, including some pictures showing just how similar the P-38 and FW-189 fighter planes are, and how clear the red star is on the side of a Yak-9. Go to beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com and click on the title for this episode, The Battle of Belgrade. I want to thank all who have supported the podcast through Patreon. Until all Ukrainian refugees can return home safely, your financial support goes to charities that help Ukrainian refugees, as you can hear at episode 85. If you like this episode or the show itself, why don't you consider following Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting app? And if you have a moment, a rating or a review on whatever app you'd like to use really helps spread the word to others interested in this part of history. You have something to say, a comment, a question, you want to point out an error? I hope I didn't make any errors, but I am only human after all. So if you have something to say, reach me by email at scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. You'll also find me, Scott Burry, author, on Blue Sky and Instagram. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. Morse code sound effect by Thane Brown. Other sound effects from Zap Splat. I'm Scott Burry. Until next episode, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina, et vive le Canada!